This is Jim Inkster. Pleased you are with us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support from Jerry Lane Chevrolet and First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Your number is 877-217-5757. Emails to talk@talklouisiana.org. And podcasts are available night and day, 24 hours, at WRKF.org and at TalkLouisiana.org. And at night, 9 p.m., if you miss the show in the morning, this program re-airs every evening, Monday through Friday at 9 o'clock, 9 and 9 on WRKF. Stephanie Grace is with us, the columnist for The Advocate, who is also a featured guest on Louisiana Considered Weekly. She is here to talk about the world at large, and 49 days away from the midterm elections, Louisiana appears to have a yawner for a Senate race at this point. And the congressional races are not competitive, with one possible exception. Clay Higgins could get pushed in Acadiana. Again, your number is 877-217-5757. Good morning, Stephanie.
Good morning.
49 days out, John Kennedy, yeah, who lost two times running for the U.S. Senate, and then one going away last time. He appears to be on cruise control, even though if one were to read his emails, which I receive, he's always talking about being out of money. And as we know, he has over $40 million.
He's always been known as a prolific fundraiser and a very aggressive one. So that did not change when he went to Washington from Baton Rouge.
And his opponents,
you know, it's going to be a media campaign. He bought an ad of the Saints game. A lot of people probably saw. I mean, that's expensive time. So
he was at the Saints game?
He bought an ad on the Saints game. There was an ad that, so that's the, you know, kind of an introductory ad, saying you trusted me as your treasurer. You trusted me you trusted me enough to send me to the Senate. I'll fight for you. That, you know, kind of very boilerplate, no issues mentioned other than the fact that he's a conservative, you know, just kind of reminding people of the general image, I think.
Last time when he finally won, he had to get past Charlie Bustani, the congressman from Lafayette, in the primary, and it actually was fairly close between those two. But once that was accomplished, he drew Foster Campbell in a runoff, and Campbell had been wounded by Caroline Fayard's challenge from the Democratic side. This time around, the Democrats once again have multiple candidates, but there really is no viable Republican running, and we know by virtue of the fact that Donald Trump carried our state by 400,000 votes twice, actually once right under 400, 399. Anyway, Trump won by about 20 points. So Kennedy is the solid favorite, and the National Democratic Party is pretty much ignoring our state, isn't it?
It is. I mean, there are they have a lot of targets, the National Democratic Party, that are much more realistic. So certainly they're looking at Georgia and Pennsylvania and Ohio even, and, you know, where the former president was the other day campaigning for J.D. Vance. I don't think we're going to see big names here campaigning for Luke Mixon, who's kind of the establishment choice. But he's doing something interesting, too, I should say. So he is an Air Force veteran, first-time candidate, running very much in the John Bel Edwards mode as a, you know, moderate to conservative outsider Democrat, and has the governor's support, actually. But he, at the beginning of the campaign, he also, like John Bel Edwards, was talking about being an abortion opponent. And that has changed in this environment. And he actually, I saw on Twitter this morning when I was scrolling through, he's launching his first broadcast ad, and it is about abortion. It's about, you know, it's the biography, it's the introducing him as a fighter pilot and all of that. But he talks about codifying Roe v. Wade. And that's a position shift for him. And it's really something that you wouldn't have seen a, quote, mainstream Democrat campaign on in Louisiana in the past, because it's such an anti-abortion state. So I think that is a measure of the underlying shift in kind of national politics and how it's filtering down to the states. So since the Dobbs decision.
Now, Mary Landrieu she won three elections for Senate as a pro-choice candidate, but she didn't talk a lot about it.
That's the difference. I mean, when it's your first ad and you're introducing people and that's what you want them to know, that to me is interesting.
Well, in Georgia, where I've been recently in the Atlanta market, every spot I saw, Stephanie, was Warnock talking about abortion and Stacey Abrams discussing abortion rights. So this is apparently these pollsters, they're telling the political consultants and the people who make these spots that this is an issue that plays well, even in the South. And we have had a sea change in the Dobbs decision. And may have saved the Senate for the Democrats. We're still 7 weeks away, but right now it is trending blue as far as the Senate, which is amazing.
Right. I think that's absolutely, if they do hold the Senate, that will be the case. And of course, you have Lindsey Graham throwing a wrench into Mitch McConnell's plans to kind of not talk about it, to, you know, shift the attention to inflation and other issues. And Lindsey Graham has introduced this bill for a nationwide ban after 15 weeks. And I think his argument is after 15 weeks in a vacuum polls well compared to a total ban, but it does undermine this argument that even he made, saying, you know, all the Dobbs decision does is throws it back to the states. And it basically lets people know in states that are more marginal than Louisiana that, you know, a national ban or some version of it is a possibility. So, you know, people are pretty angry at him, I think.
Well, they probably would rather not discuss it now. Bill Cassidy,
yes,
who has shown some courage at times, as we know, although he is still extremely conservative, but he said Graham was wrong, and he didn't use the word wrong, but we got the message. Now, John Kennedy, to my knowledge, hasn't said a word about Lindsey Graham's statement.
Not that I know of. I mean, he has been, for somebody who was a moderate Democrat the first time he ran
and pro-choice.
He is not, I don't think he's going to budge on that issue. And again, in Louisiana, probably we're not going to see, you know, this is not suddenly going to become Massachusetts or California. I do think what could happen and what will likely happen is we'll see some legislation, some attempt to institute a rape and incest exception, you know, kind of to adjust some of the very harsh legislation in a way that makes it a little less radioactive to some people, but not a sea change.
And Kennedy, listener notes, is not inclined to debate his opponents. And if I were advising him, I'd probably say, well, what do you have to gain? But nonetheless, Kennedy is an ambitious man. He may very well be running for governor. He may run for president. He may run for Senate again. He didn't debate Foster Campbell last time head up, and this time he's not inclined to even get in a debate with his challengers in the primary. Your thoughts?
And a standard, like you said, if you were an advisor, and if I were an advisor, that's what we would tell him to do. That is, if you know, the only thing you have to do, the only thing that could happen is you would say something that would hurt you. You know, if you're kind of that far ahead, you don't put yourself in that position. I mean, it's interesting that, you know, we're seeing debates over debates really heating up in some of these states where the races are very close, like Pennsylvania and Georgia. When it's not a close race, the incentive is not there for the leading candidate and the incumbent. I mean, Bill Cassidy didn't debate his opponents when he ran for re-election. It's, you know, kind of an exception was John Bel Edwards when he was running, because I think he just kind of likes to debate and feels like he always, you know.
Well, he had a horse. He had a horse race too.
He had a horse race, but also kind of personality-wise, I think he kind of always really wants to make his case and feels like, you know, I'm just being reasonable. If people would just listen to me, you know, it's kind of his outlook. But you're right, he did have more of a horse race.
Did he ever?
Yes.
All right. Tom on Bluebonnet asks, which Democrat do you think is going to finish second to John Kennedy in the primary?
Well, I mean, I guess I think I would say Mixon because he's kind of, you know, the more establishment candidate. And also he would be for someone who might otherwise vote, be inclined to vote Republican, but who's not happy with the current situation, he would be maybe the protest vote. But Chambers, I mean, do not underestimate Gary Chambers. He's, you know, I mean, if ever you did, you only had to look at how what happened when he ran for Congress, when he came very close to getting into a runoff instead of Karen Carter Peterson, who was a longtime state senator and the chair of the state Democratic Party. And he really gave her a run for her money. Now, of course, Troy Carter was above both of them, and Karen Carter Peterson, we now know, had other things going on, but that was before, you know, the criminal investigation surfaced. But he's, you know, he can raise money. He's very engaging.
We'll be back in 90 seconds with more from Stephanie Grace. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow is our producer, and your number is 877-217-5757. Stephanie Grace, columnist for The Advocate and Picayune, is based in Baton Rouge and New Orleans, and she is here to talk about politics. We do have an election in 7 weeks, and it appears at this point that John Kennedy is a likely winner in the primary.
Can I actually add one thing about Gary Chambers who we were talking about before we went to the break? You know, he's the unapologetic Democrat, and there, you know, there's a real division in Louisiana Democratic circles over kind of, do you support an unapologetic Democrat, someone who really supports your point of view, if you are a real Democratic voter, of which there are some, or the more kind of apologetic Democrats, I guess. I'm a Democrat, but not that much of a Democrat. And that's, you know, that's a deep division that goes back a number of years, and there is kind of a racial overtone to it sometimes. And it's, you know, that is playing out in this election too. And you saw that when the state Democratic Party actually endorsed 3 Democrats, you know, take your pick, Chambers, Mixon, and Sarita Steep, who's another kind of liberal, more liberal Democrat, a formerly incarcerated person, a woman in this race where, you know, in this environment where we're talking about women's, you know, reproductive health, all of that.
Paul in Opelousas, you're first up for Stephanie. Paul, good morning.
Yes, Miss Stephanie, and good morning, Jim.
Good morning.
I'm not endorsing Mr. Kennedy, but he's been our senator for a while, and some of us don't like him, some of us like him. What positive things has he done in his last term at office? Just period. I mean, what has he done positive? He's done some things. What has he done positive?
By the way, before Stephanie answers, Kennedy has just released another spot called Good Things. And he says, I voted to cut taxes, increase paychecks, fight crime, and stand up to China. But Stephanie, I'm sure politicians, even Senator Kennedy, are guilty of hyperbole at times. But what has he done? What has John Kennedy done for the great state of Louisiana?
Well, I mean, it's interesting that, you know, those are votes. Those are not like, I sponsored this legislation. But really, that's a lot of what the, you know, senators do. He is a party line Republican vote, whereas Bill Cassidy, not always. He's opposed the infrastructure package, you know, for example. He's been on the Judiciary Committee, so he has, you know, had some interesting questioning of nominees, some very insightful as a talented lawyer, some very, you know, playing to the cameras, as he often does, and getting himself kind of, you know, excoriated in the more liberal press for his tone. You know, I think it's interesting. He talks about there are some measures of effectiveness where he does well. I don't think he has a signature accomplishment in his first 6 years. So, and again, in that introductory ad that played during the Saints game, it didn't talk about legislation at all. It didn't say, I did this or I, you know, whereas Bill Cassidy, you know, infrastructure bill, if he were running, that's what you would be hearing about.
Well, Kennedy and Cassidy both have the distinction of having voted for Amy Coney Barrett for the U.S. Supreme Court, for Brett Kavanaugh, for Neil Gorsuch, and against mm-hmm. Ketanji Brown Jackson. And that brings us to the governor's election. Cassidy is looking at it. Kennedy may very well be as well. But Cassidy, if he wins, I think based on his votes against President Trump, former President Trump, he will need Democratic support. It would have seemed to me that he would have been wise to have voted for Ketanji Brown Jackson, but he did not. Why?
Maybe it was a bone to the Republicans to say, look, I'm still with you, but it is going to hurt him if he does end up in that position. You know, that's a tough, that road that he would be attempting to travel to get into the runoff is an interesting one, because he would, you know, if he got into a runoff against, say, Jeff Landry, the very conservative attorney general, obviously he would get all the Democrats and a big chunk of moderate Republicans and probably win. But to get, you know, who gets him in the runoff? Who is the, you know, when you have at least one very conservative Republican, Jeff Landry has not announced, but he had his gator hunt last week and people were wearing Team Landry for governor hats. So that's, you know, he's put some money into printing up the hats anyway. Mm-hmm. So, and, you know, there's Billy Nungesser out there, John Schroeder. There are other people who kind of the smart people looking to block Landry are trying to recruit, Garrett Graves being one. There's a lot of, you know, are there enough Republicans to put him into a runoff with the assumption that there will be a Democrat? And some people are saying, well, the Democrats have to stand down. And first of all, the Democrats don't want to stand down. And second of all, even if the Democrats, as in the Democratic establishment, stands down in Louisiana, you just have to sign up with a D next to your name and you're on the ballot. So even if it's someone who, you know, those of us in politics wouldn't consider a viable candidate, if there's someone with a D, certainly in this incredibly polarized environment, that person's going to get a lot of votes. So, you know, is there a path for Cassidy to get into the runoff, in which case he would likely be a favorite against either a Democrat or a Republican?
Well,
that's the question.
But if he gets in a runoff with a Republican, though, he will need Democratic support. And
he will. And again, that's where you get the anybody but Landry dynamic. That's where, you know, you hold your, even though we have issues with this guy, he did vote for, you know, he did vote for the Trump impeachment. He did vote for the infrastructure bill. He does work well with John Bel Edwards and you know.
Well, he also voted to uphold the election, which John Kennedy didn't and Garrett Graves didn't. They both believe that apparently that Donald Trump won the election. Gustavo and Goodwood.
They each picked a state, one state.
I know, which was to negate the election.
Their deniability, I think.
They're two of the 47 who voted with Donald Trump, saying the election was a fraud. Gustavo and Goodwood, you're on. Good morning.
Hey, good morning to you all. And well, as long as anybody replaces John Bel Edwards, I'll be very, very happy. I think he's worse than Blanco, quite honestly. And Bill Cassidy, this might be the first time that I vote Democrat, because that guy is an idiot.
Why is he an idiot, Gustavo?
Tell me, what has he done for Louisiana? Well, I mean, one thing he's done for Louisiana.
Stephanie just pointed out that he voted for the infrastructure bill. There are a lot of projects that are...
I mean, not only voted for it, he negotiated it.
How is that infrastructure... Tell me specifically what is the infrastructure bill going to do for Louisiana?
Oh,
a new bridge,
storm protection, roads and bridges, hardening the electric grid, that just off the top of my head.
And Cassidy voted for it, and most of the Republicans voted against it.
Right. And he was one of the key people to put it together, to make the deal with the Democrats, along with quite a few. I mean, again, he was not the only Republican. Was it 17, maybe? I don't remember the exact number. So it was. And in doing that, what he will tell you, which I think is true, is the Democrats needed him. So he was able to say, I want money for storm resilience. I want money for electric grid resilience. This, of course, was after Ida. He will say that he was able to get Louisiana priorities into the bill. And I think there's a lot to be said for that.
Rebel and Sherwood. Let's try to get Rebel in before the break. Rebel, okay. You're on with Stephanie. Good morning.
Hi. Thank you, Jim, and thank you, Miss Stephanie. I know you said that you didn't think that John Kennedy had any signature achievements, and I would certainly agree with that. I think that what history will remember him for is being one of the members of the Senate who voted for the first and second time only in American history to vote not to have witnesses in impeachment trials.
Yeah. And again, party line, he has become such a party line Republican, which is so interesting given his origins as a more moderate to liberal Democrat. And a lawyer. So, you know, certainly if somebody wanted to engage in the impeachment in a more sophisticated way as opposed to a political way, he would have been well positioned to do it.
877-217-5757. We'll go back to the phone lines with Stephanie Grace after this brief pause on Talk Louisiana. You're listening to Talk Louisiana, and Robin Dow is our producer. I'm Jim Inkster, and our guest for a few minutes longer is Stephanie Grace, the columnist, well-decorated writer based primarily in New Orleans, but her work, of course, appears in the newspaper of record, The Advocate, which is also the /Picayune. 877-217-5757. David in Atlanta. David, you're on with Stephanie. Good morning. Hi, David. David, the first time I've ever heard David in Atlanta not speak when called. Silence is golden, yep. I guess. But anyway, see if it's our problem or his. But I think this time it's on him. But Stephanie, 7 weeks out, and the House, a listener asked about the U.S. House of Representatives in Louisiana. Let's start local first. Every race is pretty much decided. The Democrats didn't even run a candidate against Garrett Graves, but in Acadiana, it could be a Republican who would be a prospect to unseat Clay Higgins. Holden Hoggett is a legitimate candidate, but does he have a viable shot at winning?
Well, I mean, this is likely to be a relatively high turnout election because it's a congressional midterm election. If you know, kind of it's a national election, even though there's not a ton up on for grabs here. So those elections tend to favor incumbents, you know, name recognition and all of that. Now, Clay Higgins, of course, has been a since he was elected and even before, and not just for some of his behavior, which is a little out there. Some people might say he's associated with the kind of very, very right wing in Congress. But also that, you know, there were a lot of complaints over how he handled storm recovery after Laura. He represents a district that's in Acadiana and goes all the way to Lake Charles. And there was, you know, certainly you picked up frustration out of Lake Charles with how it was represented. When Joe Biden, the you know, sitting president came to Lake Charles, for example, Clay Higgins was not there. And I think there are other members of the delegation that really tried to pick up the effort, including Garrett Graves and Steve Scalise, who's way up in the leadership, and the members of the Senate. And, you know, some aid did eventually arrive, but it's been incredibly frustrating for that community that's had one disaster after another. And, you know, he has not emerged as a champion in the way other politicians in Louisiana after storms have really risen, you know, and been very visible and like really honed in on that as their priority and, you know, kind of done some great work, members of both parties. And that is really not the rub of Clay Higgins.
877-217-5757. A listener asked about the Georgia races, which could be a bellwether for the nation. And it's the only,
well, they certainly were last time.
Yeah. And only SEC state in which Donald Trump lost. He's 21-1 in the SEC in two elections.
Oh, funny.
And, but Atlanta Journal-Constitution, latest polls in the governor's race, Brian Kemp leads Stacey Abrams 50-42. And in the U.S. Senate race, Herschel Walker, 46, Raphael Warnock, 44. That's a poll from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. It appears, as flawed as Herschel Walker is, that his Heisman Trophy may very well get him a U.S. Senate seat, and there will be one debate in that race, and Herschel according to a columnist in the Atlanta Constitution, wanted his Heisman Trophy to be on the table beside him.
Oh, hilarious. Okay. And it's funny because he's also, you know, kind of downplaying expectations, saying, well, you know, I'm not that smart. He's running. Raphael Warnock, of course, is a minister who's just very eloquent. And, you know, it's certainly interesting to have, in, you know, a state in the Deep South, two black candidates in, you know, in the lead roles. And Stacey Abrams, of course, too, running for governor. Now, I would, the governor race to me is so interesting because Brian Kemp is a Republican, but one who stood up to Donald Trump when Donald Trump was trying to get officials in Georgia to flip the election for him, even though he lost. And, you know, what's kind of interesting about that poll is it does not seem to be hurting him.
It may actually have helped him in Georgia because he could get some crossover vote, and he barely beat Stacey Abrams last time. And this, at this point, another poll has him 11 points in front. It's not looking good for Stacey Abrams. Now, the question is whether Warnock can beat a flawed candidate. And Herschel Walker may not be the brightest bulb in the room, but he's probably a lot smarter than Tommy Tuberville, the U.S. Senator from Alabama, who doesn't even know the three branches of government.
Herschel Walker is, you know, he has some baggage in terms of domestic violence allegations, and he also, you know, has said some kind of weird stuff about how climate change works or doesn't work. But he is a celebrity, and we know how far that can take you these days.
Well, Herschel Walker said, if we still have apes, could there have been evolution or something
evolution,
to that effect?
Yeah.
And by the way, years ago on this show, when Bill Cassidy used to come on every now and then, he would not embrace the theory of evolution. Bill Cassidy, Bill Cassidy. Now, either he was protecting his conservative flank, or he's an extremely evangelical person. He may believe the Earth's just a few thousand years old.
Well, you know, Bobby Gentlefudge didn't. He was a biology major at my university, so.
I think he actually believed that the Earth is only a few thousand years old. I think he went beyond it. But Cassidy is a doctor, and some would say he should know better, and others would say, look, he believes what he believes. He's a devout man, and as a person, I think he's an exceptional man, and he has shown the ability to buck the trend when he felt it was just too egregious, and he finds former President Trump, a bridge too far for his party. But he's alone in Louisiana, and he's one of the few national voices from the Republican side doing this.
And, you know, he's been censured by the state Republican Party here. So, you know, does he have a future? That's a big question. He, of course, was reelected in 2020, so he still has four more years of his Senate term if he chooses not to run for governor. I mean, even if he does and if he loses. So it's just going to be really interesting to watch how, you know, can he recover from that among Republicans? But his won him a lot of new fans who were not his fans before on the kind of moderate Democrat side.
Let's see if we can get David in Atlanta. And we missed him first go around. Let's see if he's where he says he is. David, are you there? Good morning, sir.
Yes, I'm so sorry for that drop call. Miss Grace, is the expanded Medicaid in jeopardy if a right-wing person like Jeff Landry is elected governor? Would that possibly be repealed?
You know, I don't see that happening because it is so kind of ingrained in the system by now, and it is one of the things that has, for example, kept our rural hospitals open where rural hospitals and other non-Medicaid expansion states in the South have closed. It would be very hard to untangle at this point. And he is not, I mean, he was an opponent of it. He was very active in the move to nationally get rid of Obamacare with all the lawsuits and everything. But you really don't hear him talking about that these days. So I kind of feel like it's not something he would ever cheer, but it's not go after. And there wouldn't be a lot of support. It's very popular in the state.
A listener asked a good question about how the economy will affect the national election. The Dow is down another 400 points in early trading today. It hasn't been a good year for the Biden administration on the inflation front and on the stock market front. Democrats, generally presidents, do well with the Dow Jones Industrial Average, but not this year, not for Joe Biden. Will that matter come November 8th?
Certainly the Republicans want it to matter. They would like it to be a referendum on the state of the economy. And what we were talking about earlier, the Dodd decision is really throwing a wrench into that narrative. You know, Biden kind of tries to push back. He talks about how gas prices are falling, and that's true. And I don't think that, you know, this is something people feel very acutely when their retirement is kind of dribbling away and when they go to the store and it buys less and less. And, you know, I would add in Louisiana, we're going to have insurance issues here. We have, you know, risk rating 2.0 with flood insurance. So people's flood insurance is going to go up. There are a lot of people who are losing their homeowners insurance because companies are pulling out or are going to have to go on to Citizens. That's another big bill. I mean, it's kind of one thing after another financially, and it's very tough. I think it, you know, it can't, you know, people react to kind of, in elections, people react to things that are happening to them that are very personal to them. So we have two very personal things here. We have the economy is affecting people personally, but if you're a woman, you know, healthcare and reproductive rights, that's very, very personal too. So it's really going to be interesting to see how they kind of play out.
Well, the Federal Reserve is poised to raise rates by another 0.75 points. That would be the third time. So collectively, that's 2.25 points. It's a lot of movement
right
in the wrong direction for the
and
stock market, for the stock
in,
market.
You know, that also affects your equity in your home.
Certainly.
Because, if you know, as mortgage rates are going up and they've gone up really precipitously in the last year, that means, you know, if you want to sell, the buyer is going to get, you know, has to, the kind of amount of home the buyer can afford is reduced.
And on an issue that all three of the major candidates in the U.S. Senate race agree on is assault weapons. All three are against a ban on assault weapons, including Gary Chambers. Including Gary Chambers,
yeah,
which is amazing, but
yeah,
he likes his guns.
Well, that is really interesting because that's, you know, that's an area where even John Bell Edwards, who, remember, came to us as the, you know, anti-abortion, pro-gun Democrat, has made some concessions. But, yeah.
Well, we'll see. It's getting close. And Stephanie,
yeah,
it is always good to talk with you, and keep up your great work. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We'll be back with more Talk Louisiana after this brief timeout. A reminder that the show airs both 9 a.m., 9 p.m., podcasts at WRKF.org. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. We're joined now by Daniela Mestinick-Young. She was raised in the religious cult, the Children of God, and later served as an intelligence officer for the U.S. Army for more than 6 years, reaching the rank of captain and becoming one of the first women in U.S. Army history to conduct deliberate ground combat operations when she volunteered to serve on a female engagement team. She is an amazing person. She lives with her husband and daughter in Maryland, candidate for a master's degree from Harvard Extension School in psychology, and has written a searing book called Uncultured. One of the reviews reads this way: Daniela Young's searing memoir elegantly and intricately intertwines the worlds of a religious cult and military, brilliantly displaying similarities in a way that is as undeniable as it is disturbing. And good morning to you, Daniela.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Let's get to the point as far as similarities between what most of us would not approve of, a religious cult, and most Americans still have some reverence for the military, I think for good reason. But you say that there is, unfortunately, some similarity in the way women are treated. Why?
Yeah, so, you know, I think ultimately what I've discovered through my studies is that this comes down to an issue of high control groups. And, you know, the military is one of those. A cult would be an example of one of those. And one of the issues is that if you're ever an individual, that's a problem. The whole you know, in the Army, they will literally say, all you have to do to be successful is be in the right place, the right time, the right uniform. But then as a woman, you kind of always stand out. We're less than 20% of the population to this day. And especially once you deploy, you're about 5% of the population. And so, you know, it was interesting for me coming in from this cult. I knew on my first day in basic training, like, oh, I just joined another cult. And not in a bad way. To me, it was like, I know how to fit in a group. I know how to kind of put my head down and do the work. I was much more surprised to find kind of this environment of sexual harassment and rape culture to be, you know, in my opinion, almost equally as bad in the U.S. Army as it was in the sex cult.
Well, you write about your experience in a captivating way in Afghanistan, for example, in 2014. There's a chapter, Take One for the Team. What do you mean?
So, you know, the book is kind of my journey through, you know, coming from this cult and then trying to fit into American society and ultimately the Army. And there's this theme that I kind of feel like I'm running and trying so hard to fit in. And I finally, you know, do work for this amazing leader and do have this great team. But ultimately, you know, the military is still really figuring out how to treat women. And I get embroiled in this sexual harassment scandal that is sort of getting out of control. And at one point I'm just told by a senior officer, like, look, we know you didn't do anything wrong here, but for political reasons, someone has to take one. And we expect you to take one for the team. And that was the point I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I need y'all to know my whole story because, you know, I cannot just, first of all, take one for the team. That has never really made me a part of it, that I've had to fight, you know, all women have to fight so hard to be accepted. But also just, you know, I'm not the one making the environment in the military dangerous for women. And this is a much larger issue and story that I thought needed to be told.
And you were a captain at the time.
Yes.
So you were an officer, and why were you chosen to be the one to take one for the team?
So, you know, I think it's interesting example of what we call the double bind for women, where, you know, earlier in the book, I talk about how pretty much from day one in basic training, we're told, you know, women in the Army are either a bitch, a slut, or a dyke. And, you know, the last two options there are not great. Especially the last one being illegal to be homosexual at the time. You know, the whole culture of the Army is if you're a woman, you have to be super hard. You have to be super tough. And when I finally get to that point where I am congratulated on being the ultimate super tough woman, that's part of what is then used to take me down, because it's the, you know, women can't support each other. But it was really just something that spiraled out of control and had to do with the culture of the Army that I had been trying to point out for many years. And it was not something I was going to go along with.
Uncultured is the book from Daniela Mestinick-Young. It's described as a tremendous story of grit and determination by Julia Shiras, the New York Times bestselling author of Jesus Land. Now, you write that the hardest lie you ever told yourself was that you were strong enough. What do you mean?
I think I did the thing that many trauma survivors do, and especially I know a lot of us from cults do, is when we get out in the outside world, we try to just walk away from all the trauma and say, it's fine, I survived it. I can just go on to my next thing. I don't want to talk about it. And I think I also really kind of internalized the cult's idea that the outside world is out to get you. And so I felt like in order to fit in and in order to build my life from nothing, I came to America with $0, you know, I had to just be perfect all the time. And I somewhat believed that if I was perfect enough and worked hard enough and in the Army ran fast enough, then I could prove that I deserved to be here and feel like I fit. And ultimately, Uncultured is the story of me finding out how flawed that idea is that you can just walk away from trauma and never have to kind of revisit it and understand what it did to your life and your future.
And yet you saw combat action.
Yes. you know, I think it was interesting in a way that arriving in Afghanistan for the first time at 23 years old was kind of my big PTSD triggering event. And it wasn't so much to do with the war, but to do with being once again locked on this base, mm-hmm. which is essentially a very large commune, and being surrounded by all of these threats of violence, both sexual and non-sexual. That was a big thing for me. The combat, I think, is probably less scary to a lot of us women than just being over there in general.
One of the passages in Daniela's book reads, "Nobody noticed how much weight I was losing, partly because I was dwarfed in a uniform not designed for anyone built like a woman. My hands started shaking so much that I could barely hold the cup of caffeine that was my constant companion. I'd bitten my fingernails to the quick, cuticles torn and bleeding, medical tape always wrapped around the worst wounds. The lactation symptom that I'd noticed earlier got stronger, more painful, and impossible to ignore." So you are fortunate to come out reasonably okay on the other side, but as you noted, you're a creature, as we all are, of our past. And unfortunately, we've read stories, and a listener asked about rapes in the military. And you are no stranger to sexual assault, having been in a cult, in a cult. So tell us how the experience that preceded your inclusion in the Army affected you moving forward, and whether you have faced some of the same kinds of fights for your life and your sexual freedom in the Army as you did in a cult.
Yeah, in the cult, it was, I was growing up in a time when supposedly they had fixed everything in the cult and everything was great and we were people that loved Jesus. But of course, in any organization, when you don't fix your values, it's still quite toxic. And, we were all children growing up in these religious prison camps where we were controlled, and many, many, many of us were sexually abused. But I would say the biggest kind of rule was we don't talk about it, and we are coached not to talk about it. And then, in the military, it's essentially the same thing. And when I, upon leaving the cult, had been once again very badly assaulted and told myself, like, this will never happen to me again. I will fight it. I will report it. I won't be a victim. And then when it does eventually happen to me again in the Army, after being warned by my bosses that it probably would happen, the sexual assault, I ended up in a situation where I was armed and I was clearly in the right, but I couldn't report it because of the Army's regulations and the culture, and I unquestionably would have lost my job. And so that, is, I think, what makes it such a lasting, traumatic experience was that I couldn't go get support afterwards.
We only have a few moments left, Daniela, but how hard was it to write this book?
Oh my gosh. I was really fortunate that I was not writing it by myself. I had at first one partner and then two, and a wonderful editor. And even writing with a team of four women, it was one of the hardest things I've done in my life, as was recording the audiobook. And I specifically think, in the middle of the book, it's chapter 17, I just had to make a choice to put it all on the page or keep trying to be perfect. And I chose to put it on the page. I think it changed my life. And I hope that other people can kind of see their own struggles.
The book is Uncultured, from Daniela Mastanik-Young. Signature support from First Financial and from Jerry Lane Chevrolet.